Hello, my name is Tim Schwartz, and welcome to the Life After Blindness Spotlight. This is the podcast where I interview someone connected to the blind and visually impaired community. Please join me as we explore their journey with a life after blindness. This week, my guest is from lifeaftersightloss.com, Derek Daniel. Hello and welcome to the Life After Blindness Spotlight. I am your host, Tim Schwartz, and this week I'm speaking to a YouTuber, blogger, and podcaster from lifeaftersightloss.com, Derek Daniel. Hello, Derek. Welcome to the Life After Blindness Spotlight.
Hi, Tim. Glad to be here.
So, Derek, I know that you weren't born blind, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the episode of the podcast, but as I always like to do, I like to paint a picture of the person before the blindness. So in cases where people were born blind, obviously they're going to have a different story than someone who was blind later in life. And so in a case like this, I want to go back and paint that picture of you, Derek Daniel, before the blindness. So if you could talk to me a little bit about your life, where you grew up, where you're from, and a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was born on a cold, rainy day. My life started off unique. I'm actually adopted, and I was adopted when I was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks old. And the family that adopted me, I grew up in southern Indiana in a very, very, very small town with like 2 stoplights, one of those. It was a great family. I always knew I was adopted. People ask me, when'd you find out? And like, I didn't find out when I was 15. Like, I'm adopted? What? I always knew. I used to say like I was a chosen child and things like that. And so it was just an interesting life starting off because I wasn't, I wasn't like my sister who she's biological, or as we used to say, or she used to say that she's real and I'm fake. although I used to say that mom and dad chose me and they got stuck with you. So we had some good banter back and forth. But growing up in the household, it was, very classic small town America kind of growing up. And I was always tried to be the center of attention, which was much different than my family. They did their work. They went to work every day. They did the classic thing. And I was like, everybody look at me. So I can remember once when we went to Disney World when I was about 4. They wanted volunteers to come up on stage and do something. And I was like, yeah, pick me. And my parents were like mortified, like, oh my gosh, what's he doing? So I think from a young age, I was always going to be in front of people and doing things like that. So it was in my blood. And I've actually since met my birth family and I have a couple of siblings and they're like, you must've gotten all that talent because we don't do any of that. So it's been interesting just to kind of have that dynamic.
Now, when you met your birth family, was that before or after your loss of vision?
That was after I lost my vision, a few years afterwards.
Did they have any reaction to that at all? Or
They didn't actually know. Because of what I have, it's very sporadic. And so there was no like clear, everybody's going blind in the family or anything like that. So they were surprised by it. And they didn't know anything about this disease or anything like that as well. So they were like taken aback. And my birth mother, not to get into too much graphic detail, but my birth mother was divorced from my siblings' parents and was with somebody else. So they're actually half siblings and they did not know she was pregnant. So it's like, it's one of those Lifetime movies where I show up. I'm like, hey, I'm your brother. And they're like,
surprises all around. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, hey, I'm your brother. And by the way, you carry this gene for this disease. Congratulations.
So now, we're still in your childhood, so you've been adopted, obviously very, very young age. You said a few weeks, is that correct?
Yeah, just about 3 or 4 weeks.
3 or 4 weeks. And so, as you said, you had a family who chose you, yes, as opposed to you being, blessed upon. And so, although you could say you've still been blessed upon, my brother is adopted into our family, and it's the same thing. We chose him as well as we're blessed upon, so I understand.
Yeah.
And so, you talked about how you always knew that eventually you were going to be that person to want to be in front of people or talking to people. Tell me a little bit about your interests as a young child. What were the things that you were interested in as far as, you know, creativity or other things?
I was always interested in the Power Rangers. I actually did a video recently about nostalgia, and I talked about the Power Rangers. But no, I love superheroes, and I loved, you know, boy stuff like that. But I never really enjoyed sports. Like, I played sports. I played soccer and, you know, Little League and things like that. But I wasn't going to grow up and play sports. That was just not my thing. I much more got into things like Star Wars and superheroes and comics and stuff like that. So I always, you know, I can remember having like a book with like a record in the back. I play a record of like Star Wars stories and stuff. So I always liked the idea of like movies and creating things and, you know, all that kind of thing. So as I got older, on into middle school and stuff, you know, I started in the band, but I realized I was going to get lost in the shuffle. Plus, I wanted to be the center of attention, you know, anyway. So, and playing an instrument was too much hard work. I was like, oh, I've got to practice. This is awful.
What instrument did you play?
I started off on the oboe and found out that was didn't have enough air. And then I played the French horn for a couple of years. I sat second chair out of three, and it was just like, I'm not good at this. And I actually ended up switching to, in my eighth grade year, I switched and went to a Christian school for a year. And so I didn't do the band anymore, and found out in that school, like, obviously there was a much smaller number of kids, and I was able to kind of do some things and express myself and, you know, do some performing and such, and on a small scale. And I found out how much I loved it and I enjoyed it. And then when I went back to my public high school in ninth grade, then that really started kicking off the performance bug in me.
Well, that was going to be my next question. What was it, if it was one thing or a series of things, what was it that got that passion for performing and being out there in front of people? What brought you to that?
Well, I think I always enjoyed the idea of being up in front of people, and whether I was speaking, singing, dancing, whatever I would do. When I first really started singing publicly, I was like 12, 13, and my voice was changing. So it was like nobody ever knew what I was going to sound like. But I just enjoyed the idea of like being up there and being able to make people laugh or make people smile or make them, you know, even if it was like a tearjerker, make them have an emotion, you know, like entertain them to a certain point. And so when I, in ninth grade, I auditioned for the show choir. And because I went to a small school, I was one of the only boys. And so it was like, you know, a big deal if you had talent and you were a boy. And it was like, yeah, okay. And so people kind of started to know who I was, and I got some recognition, and just the idea of like being up there and singing and dancing and all that sort of thing. So ninth grade really started going. And then I auditioned for a play, and I'll never forget the play was, it was this play called Arsenic and Old Lace. And it was a movie with Cary Grant way back in the day. And it's about these two old ladies who are killing old men and burying them in the basement. But anyway, I played a character who in the movie was played by, I think his name was Peter Lorre.
Yes.
And Peter Lorre had this interesting accent, if I remember correctly. And so he was like, he said one of the characters in Arsenic and Old Lace he was buddies with was named Johnny. And in the script, it was written out C-H, and so he called him Chani. That was his, like, accent. And so I said, when I went to the directors, I said, is it okay if I do this audition for this part with an accent? And they're like, yeah, that'd be great. So I was like, okay. And so I did it with the accent, all this weird stuff, and I was like, and people were like, whoa, that's so neat. And, you know, again, I went to a small school. So then when I found that, I was like, oh, if I do something different, if I'm a little unique, that would be very cool. So from then on out, I really tried just to be different, be unique. And whether I had a bit part or the lead part, I always tried to do my best to be remembered and memorable. And it's exhilarating, you know, being up there. It was a lot of fun.
From there, you definitely caught the bug.
I did, yes. The bug caught me for sure.
Can you still do the accent?
It's one of those things. Like, he was like very whiny, like, no, Johnny. You know, it's one of those, like, it was almost racist, I think.
I'll take it.
I can remember, it was the first time I ad-libbed too on stage, because he had to light a candle because it was dark, and he had this old. He was supposed to have, you know, his, I don't know, early 40s maybe. And we had a lighter, like a very not 1940s lighter. And so we were trying to light it. And I don't know why I said this, but I said, like, oh, Johnny, it's childproof. And everybody, the guy who was in it turned because he was laughing. And I didn't really think all that much of it. You know, it wasn't like I was thinking this is going to be hysterical. I'm just going to say it.
Right.
I just said it and everybody laughed because that was so out of character for the 40s or whatever it was.
Right.
And so that was the first time I really got that ad lib, which I love to do now as well. And so that play really, it you know, it set me apart.
And when you say something like that and you get such an organic and immediate response, especially on stage, there are people that say there's no bigger thrill. And I know a lot of other people at different careers and different experiences, that's that kind of thrill that just gets you going, whether it's on stage or, you know, doing some other sort of sport or athletics or something like that. That organic feedback, that immediate feedback is such a thrill. And I can see where you got the bug from there, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the main thing was the script was funny, but in that moment I was funny. You know, it, like, I could say the script and do the acting and it was funny, but when I came up with that all on my own, which I didn't realize at the time, I was just saying something because I thought it was funny. I was funny, you know, and the audience was laughing at me. And so I was making that part, that moment, my own. And I think that's really where that unique sort of feeling comes from.
So as we're continuing to paint this picture on the way to you becoming blind, we've heard you say, you know, that you caught the creative bug, obviously, and the performance bug, talked a little bit about your interest in movies and things like that. So at this time, you also said that you really weren't in the sports, although you did a little bit of sports when you were younger. Were there other things that you found, or as you found later in life, yeah, these are the things that I've held on to, these are the things that I did as a kid before I was blind that I'm still, this is still a major part of me now?
Obviously the performance part. I did, I married my high school sweetheart. So technically she was an interest in high school and I've held on to her the whole time. Cause we started dating when we were 15. So, but yeah, I mean, I still like that kind of stuff. You know, I've seen all the latest superhero movies and I'm watching all the Star Wars coverage. And so all that kind of, like, I don't want to say geeky, but, you know, geeky childhood stuff that I enjoyed, I still enjoy today. In fact, I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt right now. Like, all that kind of stuff has just flowed with me through childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, all the way to now. You know, my son and I, who's 11, you know, we go see the Star Wars movies and the superhero movies and that sort of thing. So I'm still kind of that kid at heart. Who likes all that stuff, and I probably always will be, because it's just, I don't know, it's something where you can, it's kind of like that fantasy where you escape into, and, you know, that aspect of it has always stayed with me.
Absolutely. Now, if you don't mind saying, for reference for the discussion, how old are you now?
I just turned 34 last month.
Oh, happy birthday. So let's talk about that transition from childhood through being a teenager and then losing your vision. You lost your vision at 18 years old, correct? Or started to lose it, I should say, at 18 years old.
I was 18 when I lost it, yes.
And so tell the listeners a little bit about that. How did you find out? What was, you know, your initial reaction in the family? And then if you could tell the listeners a little bit about what your vision loss is.
Sure. What I always tell little kids is it's because I didn't eat my green vegetables. But so I turned 18 in March of 2001, and I graduated high school that same year. So I graduated in May, and then sometime in June, I was driving home from a date with my girlfriend, then girlfriend, now wife, and I reached up to, like, I don't know, wipe my right eye, and I closed it, and I noticed this spot in my left eye out in the center. And then when I'd open my right eye, I could, of course, that right eye would take over and I could sort of see again. And I was like, that's really weird. And so I'm Mr. Optimist, and I was like, it'll be fine. So then a couple of weeks later, I told my mother, and she, like, passed out on the floor. And then I picked her, you know, and she was like, go to the ophthalmologist or go to the optometrist. And I was like, okay. So the optometrist in our little bitty town, of course, we knew. And actually the summer I lost my sight, I was working at a local little theme park. And his daughter was my supervisor. So, you know, it's one of the small town things. So he tested me, he said, cover your left eye. And, you know, we did the whole chart. And he said, cover your right eye. And he said, what can you see? And I was like, I can't see the chart. And he was like, that's not good. So
definitely not.
Yeah. So he sent me to an ophthalmologist, and through this, the course of back and forth, you know, doctor visits, my right eye started to deteriorate as well. And so the ophthalmologist at the time said, here's some things we're going to test for. And I got tested for a brain tumor. I got tested for MS. I got tested for a couple other, you know, just random things, blood test. I had some steroids pumped into me and just a variety of things. And finally, he was like, I think I know what it is, but I can't say for sure. So I'm going to send you up to this other doctor in Indianapolis. And I went up to this doctor and he said, with all the symptoms you have, we believe it's called it's something called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, and words I'd never heard of. And, you know, and it was like, what? So basically, from the time I first noticed my vision, you know, in that left eye to the time I got my diagnosis was about 2 months. 2 months total. And so basically Leber was a doctor, I think, who named this disease, but it's hereditary optic neuropathy, which basically means it's, you know, something passed down through the family and it's sort of the death of your optic nerve. My nerve swelled really big and the center part of it died and it was damaged and then it went back to normal size. And I don't have a clue why it did that or why it's damaged. It's a mitochondrial issue, which means it's passed down through the mother. And so it's a long sort of, you know, medical thing. I won't go into all of it, but basically the mother passes it to the children. And then usually one or more of the boys will go blind and the daughters will pass it on to their children. That's why when I was adopted, letting them know about it was important because I have a half sister who has passed the gene on to, you know, her children. So it was important to let them know, you know, what we found out about it.
Yeah. Cause obviously potentially one of her children could possibly have the same thing happen. And so having that preparation is definitely a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when this happened, you said that this happened before you graduated, where you were having the issues when you're driving on that date with your then girlfriend, now wife. So talk to me about the people around you and even, of course, your own response. You know, what was this like for, you know, your home life and your, you know, again, your girlfriend then who now has married you, although I think that kind of speaks for itself. Obviously that went well, but tell me a little bit about how, you know, what were the emotions around then? Obviously we can assume, but I never want to assume those emotions. Everybody handles things in different ways. So tell us a little bit about your family and yourself, you know, your girlfriend. What was the initial reaction to this whole new way of life?
Well, I think it was bad timing, which I don't know if there's ever good timing, but it was bad timing because all my friends were leaving for college and I couldn't. And so that was very hard because then I was left at home alone with, you know, all my friends gone. Like, because I was really close friends with everybody in my class, or maybe I should say everybody I was friends with was in my class. And so, like, you know, my girlfriend, all my close friends, they all went off to college and here I was sitting at home alone. And that was the same year, of course, 9/11 happened. And so I was, you know, home watching TV when that all went down. So it was a bad year all around for us. But, you know, my parents really didn't know how to react. There's only like one other blind person in our town. And so we didn't know what blindness even meant for that, you know, in that regard. And I'm not totally blind, so I have not lost all my vision. I have usable vision left. So it was like dancing that line between sighted and blind. And so how do we deal with that? I think for a while I was real optimistic and, you know, it was almost denial if I look back at it now. But it was like, oh, everything's going to be great. My life's great and wonderful and everything's going to be fine. And while those are true statements, I think having to realize that, you know, it's hard and facing that can be difficult. So I didn't have a lot of people around me. And even when I went off to college later on, I had a guide dog then. And then that was a whole nother issue because, you know, friends didn't want to take me in their car because I had a yellow dog who liked to leave himself everywhere and, you know, yellow spots all over the place. And so it was really difficult and isolating. That's a really good word to describe it. So it was very isolating in those first, probably the first year, as a matter of fact.
Do you remember there being any one particular or multiple things that got you past that isolation, or was that, or does that go more in towards when you went to college? You know, what was it that helped you get through that, I guess, is my question.
A couple of things. I think first I went to, in November of 2001, I went to get a guide dog at a place called Leader Dogs for the Blind. And in Michigan, they're a great organization. And I met a lot of other blind people that were totally blind people that had some vision, less and more than me, you know, and just a variety of people. And so that really was, for no pun intended, really eye-opening. And they were able to teach me a lot of things because, again, I just lost my sight, you know, 6 months or whatever, less than 6 months. And so I'll never forget asking one lady who had lost her sight to a brain tumor, and she woke up and had no vision. Mm. And so I went to her room and I walked in and I said, oh, do you want me to turn the lights on? And she said, what does it matter? And I kind of laughed, and we both laughed, you know, and so I realized that my vision's different than her vision, you know, and so we're, you know, not only were we different people, but we had different vision. And they just taught me a lot about, you know, moving on with life and going forward and doing things. And then I can remember in college that semester, it was the spring semester of 2002, I met a girl who was actually the daughter of the, I think, superintendent of the School for the Blind in Indiana.
Okay.
And she was phenomenal. She was supportive and helpful. And when I felt bad, she was encouraging. She, you know, pulled me out of my room because it was kind of, you know, I was like, oh, I'm not going anywhere. And so she was very impactful in those first, probably that first year. So things like that, where it was like, you know what, I've got to drag myself out of this, and I can't do it myself. And so having people like that to teach me things, to, you know, whatever. And then finally, I think that summer of 2002, I had a friend of mine who was directing a musical, and she said, I want to do this musical, which was actually a musical I had done in high school called Crazy for You. And I had done it in high school, and it was wonderful and awesome. And I was like, oh, I felt terrible. I'm never going to do this again. And she said, I want to do this musical. And she said, I won't do it without you, though. And I was like, I've got to do it. And I was able to do it. And the day, the anniversary of the first year, which was when I got my diagnosis, I was doing a musical. And so it was like, you know what? I'm going to be able to do this. And so I think that was those kinds of that progression helped me to, you know, really. Now, don't get me wrong, I still had more to deal with, but at least it got me far enough along to say, I can do this, and life's going to be okay.
Sounds like you were lucky enough to be in a position where, even though you were isolated, even though you were perhaps even depressed, you know, it's almost like losing vision is almost like losing a limb. You know, a lot of people have described it that way, that it is truly like losing an arm, losing a hand, you know, losing something like that, because it is a major piece of you that you use all the time that is now, mm-hmm. you know, either losing some, as in your case, where you're losing vision, or people that have lost their vision totally. And so you're, you know, having to learn or relearn to do things in some situations. And of course that can cause those feelings of being isolated and being depressed and wondering to yourself, gosh, can I do this? Am I going to be able to do the things that I love? All the things we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, all your mm-hmm. interests about performing and music and all these different interests that you have. And so I think you were in a good situation where it sounds like between your family, your friends, people that you met in school, you were in a good spot there to have people to help guide you through and help you to realize, no, it is possible to still live the life that I want to live going forward. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was just very blessed in the opportunities I was given. I ended up transferring schools to a different college and rooming with a good friend of mine who actually got to be, you know, even closer as friends. And I was involved in the theater program there. And while I still dealt with depression and stress and anxiety and things like that along the way, you know, good, solid people in my life who they didn't necessarily say, like, get up and get out of, you know, they were just there and they never left. And that's, I think, what was key and what was most important is the relationships I had, you know, after the fact, after the sight loss, they remained and they stayed. And nobody thought of me as a blind person. They thought of me as Derek. And that was really, I think, what was important.
And I like that point that you made about the people around you not necessarily being, you know, motivational speakers or drill sergeants to say, hey, Derek, get up, do this. You know, they were just there for you. They were just friends. They cared for you. If you needed their help, they were available. And that's what you needed in that period of time. You didn't need, maybe you didn't even want somebody to be that drill sergeant person, you know, trying to, you know, motivate you in other ways. Just having somebody there to just, even if they understood it themselves or not, maybe they didn't even fully understand, you know, what's going on, but they were there as an outlet for you to help you get through those times.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had my roommate in the college I transferred to, he was and still is one of my best friends. And I had my guide dog at the time, and there would be mornings when I just wouldn't get out of bed, and he would come over and make sure my dog would go out to the bathroom and stuff like that. And, you know, he took care of me in a way that he may have not even realized, you know what I mean? It's one of those things, sure, where he didn't think about, like, I need to take care of you. He just was my friend. And, you know, he challenged me occasionally and he'd ask me questions. But like you said, if he was trying to be a drill sergeant or, you know, Tony Robbins or whatever, it would have not gone over well at all. I'd been like, get out, I hate you. And so it just wouldn't have worked. But he was just my friend. And that was a big component.
So as you're progressing through college, because this obviously was a transition you were making right at the end of high school going into college. So did you find anything with college, with your sight loss, more difficult? Was there something, anything more challenging than what you had found in high school prior to losing your vision? Was there anything you had to do differently?
Well, I think that I went to, I went to Indiana State University, and they had a very good student services department for, I'm not sure what the phrase is now, but I called it student services back then. And so they had a much bigger department, and then they, you know, they kind of knew what to do and how to help you and that sort of thing. Then I transferred to USI, the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville. Now, it is a much bigger school now, and so it's probably gotten better, but at the time it was pretty new, and the student services department was still pretty small and new, so they weren't quite sure how to handle everything. So that was a little difficult. And navigating around was difficult too, like just finding your way around. Eventually, you know, you find your way and you do okay. But all those things that my friends got to experience first, I had to experience kind of, quote, on my own, because they had already had all their first college experiences. Like, you know, hey, I'm going to the cafeteria. And they're like, yeah, we go there all the time. It's like, oh, okay. Or like, I'm going to this building. It's like, yeah, we go there all the time. It's like, dang it. So I think that was the hard part too, was like, I was doing this by myself. I wasn't necessarily alone all the time. And I had some, you know, people to come alongside, but it really fed into that isolated feeling. So those kinds of things, those little things, I mean, yeah, learning to do, how do you do a test? How do you do stuff on the whiteboard or chalkboard that they're drawing, you know, figuring out those things, that was difficult. But I think it was the overarching sense of like doing it by myself. I think that was the thing I was trying to overcome.
So then as you make it through your college years, and we've talked about some of those obstacles and what you've had to do and the good friends and relationships that you had that really sounds like helped you through those years. Talk to me about completing college and where you went from there. What was the next step?
So I got married when I was 20, which we don't highly recommend to people getting married when they're 20, but we did, and we've made it so far, so we're doing pretty good. But we got married when we were 20, and then my wife actually got a job as a nurse in Evansville, and we were living in a little small house. And then actually, I started working at a church, and that's one of the things I really haven't talked about a whole lot. My family was Christian, and so we went to a church all my life, and I was always involved in that. And there was a church that wanted me to come start a drama team, and so I said okay. And then that sort of morphed into helping with the youth, and then I had you know, people just really speak into my life. And so I started working there as the youth pastor for a while, and then I was the associate pastor, you know, probably without the title, but it was one of those things in church. You do a little bit of everything, led the worship and, you know, helped out and that sort of thing. So after that, I think the performance part of me started to go not away. It's not like I never wanted to perform, but I transferred from like being an entertainer solely to using those skills and abilities in more of a ministry capacity. So then we started settling in and, you know, and into married life in a more sort of quote unquote normal way.
And so how was doing that as far as the different ministries within the church, being the youth pastor, as you said, you know, doing different jobs all throughout the church as sometimes is necessary. Did your blindness have any good, bad, or indifferent effect on that, or was it even an issue?
I think it's always it's one of those things. Blindness is never the centerpiece per se, but it's always there. And so, you know, just different things from accessibility to, you know, I do a little bit of preaching, or if I played music, I'd have to memorize all the music. And if I helped out with the youth group, I had to make sure that I had somebody else there that was sighted. So if the kids tried to start making out, then, you know, they could catch them, you know, just different things like that. Sure. So, yeah, it was always part of it. But I will say the pastor of the church, who was an older gentleman, he was I don't think he ever talked about it, but he always gave me chances just to do something. You know, I was like, well, let's do this. You know, it wasn't like he's like, well, what about your blindness? Is that bad? Is it going to, it's like, let's just do it. And, you know, we'll just give it a shot. And if it works, you know, and he never questioned, you know, the fact that I was blind or anything like that. So it was a great environment just to try things out and say like, well, how am I going to preach? How am I going to have notes? Or how am I going to, you know, lead the worship? Or can I use a computer in this capacity and that sort of thing? So we tried it. And if it worked, it worked. And if it didn't, we tried it another way. Or, you know, I was never hindered by it by any means.
He gave you the free rein to just be yourself. And it was up to you to find out how you had to accommodate that.
Yeah, and it was almost like he didn't, like, this sounds bad to say it this way, but he just really didn't concern himself with my visual impairment. Okay. You know, he was just like, well, either you're going to do it or you're not going to do it. You know, he's like, you're not called into ministry because of your blindness. You're called into ministry because of who you are. And so if you're really called, then you got to do it. And if you're going to do it, then figure it out. You know, it's one of those things.
Sure.
Now, it's not that he wasn't helpful or anything like that. He was just like, yeah, well, here's what you're going to do. He helped me with all the stuff ministry-wise, and then it was like, I'll figure out this blindness kind of as we go along. I'll figure out how I need to, you know, do whatever I need to do. And, you know, and like I said, I tried different things. Like when I'd preach, I'd have somebody else read the scripture, or I'd memorize it or whatever. And we had it was a small church. And so people were just very accommodating. I'm like, this week I'm going to have Joe read this. And they're like, okay, well, whatever. You know, they didn't think about it because I didn't make it a big deal. You know, I was like, I'm blind. What are we going to do? It's like, you got to preach. You're going to preach? Yeah. Okay, well, then do it. So I just had to figure it out.
Exactly. So how long did you do that with the church?
I was with that church for, let's see, I was with that church for about 6 years, and then we actually moved moved cities. I moved up to Indianapolis and started working with a new church in 2010.
And that's where you've been ever since?
Yeah, I was with that church until 2015, and I resigned from that position.
Oh, I see. Okay. So now in there somewhere, I know between those periods, you and your wife started a family. Talk to me a little bit about blind fatherhood and having children in the mix. How did that affect things? Did it make anything different? Or again, like with the ministry, was it just kind of the same, just making accommodations? You know, talk to me a little bit about blind fatherhood.
Yeah, I think I have to say that my wife, even during the going blind transition, she has always been, I don't know if there's a word, like, it's just one of those things where we just did it. You know, we didn't sit down and have a 4-hour conversation about how to accommodate ourselves or what. We just roll with it, and whatever we have to do, we just do, and we figure it out. And so parenthood was, you know, just one of those things. Blindness is not an excuse in our house. You know, my wife will never allow blindness to be an excuse. And so when we got pregnant, I can remember when she first told me, because my wife's a terrible liar. So she was giggling when she told me that the test was positive. Well, I thought she was lying because she was like giggling. I was like, it's not true. She had to like take a picture and like blow it up. Like, I can't remember how we did it. Maybe she had a magnifier. I don't know. She had to show me the pregnancy test. And so I was like, okay, well, so we were living in a small house, and I said, okay, the first thing we need to do is move so the baby doesn't have to sleep on the dryer.
Sure.
And so then we did it. And just all along the way, we tried things out, and we said, okay, how's this going to work? And when we come across it, then we just, you know, faced it. One of the things was we took the class, you know, from the baby, and we had this big like fake doll thing and changing the diaper and because there was never a moment where my wife was like, you know what, you're not going to have to do all this because you're blind. I had to. In fact, my wife worked nights at the time, and she had just gotten the job in, I want to say May, and my son was born in December. So she hadn't been working there very long. So she only got 6 weeks off after a C-section. Kudos to my wife for being able to. She's awesome. She has a much higher pain tolerance than I do. But she worked nights, and so she had to go back to work. And there I was with the baby at 6 weeks old. And so I had to get up in the middle of the night, change diapers, you know, do the bottle. It wasn't a matter of saying like, oh, you're blind. And so, no, I was a dad. I just happened not to be able to see very well.
Right.
And so all the things we did, those 6 weeks was like crash course. If I had a question, we had to figure it out, because then that first night she was gone and I couldn't just be like, hey, can you come home real quick? Well, no, there was none of that. So I figured it out. And just all along the way, that's what we did. And we kind of talked about that on the podcast I was on before, you know, just learning to do things as we went along.
If you're anybody interested in getting a much more in-depth conversation about Derek and his life as a blind father, you can check that out on lifeafterblindness.com/6. And you can hear him talk a lot more about the accommodations he had to make and things that he has had to do as a blind father. Some simple, some a little bit more advanced, some silly, but they work. And I've definitely been there when you were talking about going to the class and having to diaper the doll. I remember that well. I've been through that myself. And so I understand. You just make it work. Although the doll they gave me was a really large doll and I had a very small diaper and I wasn't quite sure how we were supposed to make that work. but we figured it out. But like you said, it's just finding accommodating ways to do things a little differently than is if you had all your vision or more vision.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I can remember, some of my family, they were like, oh, well, let me do this. I'll do this. And that sort of thing. And my wife was like, no, he's going to do this. Like, and it was never a matter of like getting into a scuffle or anything, but it was always just like, my wife always expected it of me. And I think that's why if she never expected it of me, she wouldn't have challenged me to do it. And then I wouldn't have done it. And so things like that, without that, again, she wasn't like some drill sergeant. She just expected me to do it because I was their parent. And so then I did it because I was their parent.
Yeah, she didn't look at you as Derek, the blind father. She looked at you as Derek, her husband, who she has faith in despite the blindness.
Absolutely.
So as your children have grown and you've gone from one church to another and continued the ministry and working with people and children throughout ministry and your faith, you seem to take a circle back a little bit to your childhood interests, wanting to be out there in front of people more than just in a ministry standpoint. And you probably do what I do with my child, where you perform for the children. taking that a little bit further back to your interests that we talked about earlier from childhood, you got into podcasting first, correct? You did a little bit of podcasting before YouTube. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I started podcasting in 2015.
And so if you'd like, tell me a little bit about that experience and what you learned and then how you transitioned that into what you've done the last year or so from the date of this episode on YouTube and kind of carry me into the present.
So I started podcasting in the spring of 2015, just as kind of like a whim. Like, I wanted to do that because I thought that was so cool. I was like, I could have my own kind of radio show. Like, that's neat. And so I was like, I'm going to do it. And so I, you know, researched it and figured it out. And I really thought about doing, I wanted to do a podcast for the church I was working for. But then I just sort of broke off and I was like, I'm going to do a podcast. I had one called The Blind Odyssey, which I think has how we met originally way back in the day.
It is. I had stumbled upon it while looking for other blind podcasts and happened to find it and had contacted you then. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that podcast ran about 20 episodes, and it was one of those things where it was my first sort of foray into podcasting. And You know, it didn't last just because of whatever. But I think that I learned a ton about it. And through that process, I ended up resigning from the church. And then, and it wasn't under bad circumstances by any means. I just felt like, without going too crazy spiritual, I just felt like that's what God would have me to do. And so I ended up resigning and staying home with the kids and, you know, being sort of a stay-at-home dad and working on that. And so from that, then I had a lot more time to content create. And so I tried some other podcasts and none of those were really working. And then, like you said, about a year ago, I started making some videos on YouTube talking about visual impairment, but talking about like sight loss and dealing with sight loss and things like that. And I don't know, it was kind of like cathartic a little bit. And so whenever I would make those, it was very simple. I'm a webcam and nothing crazy, you know, whatever. So I did a few videos and then I just sort of trailed off for a little bit, was working on another project. And I had some people contact me because I noticed I had some subscribers and I had some more views and I had some comments and people were asking if I was going to do some more videos. They really enjoyed them. And I was like, I hadn't thought about it, but maybe. And so, you know, I was talking to my wife and I thought, well, I'll just make some more. I could probably do that, you know. And so I started making a few more. And slowly the channel became this thing dealing with life, discovering life after sight loss. And so it was like, I know my experience and what I went through. And I'm sure there's other people, because I didn't have anybody to really walk me through it. I had to kind of just figure it out. And I thought, I'm sure there's other people out there. So I just started doing some product reviews. I talked about feelings and emotions and things that people might go through. We talk about technology and so forth. And so I just started getting, you know, consistently in these video, in this production of videos. I met a couple of other blind YouTubers and they really helped me out. And so it was kind of like, wow, this is really encouraging and I'm actually helping people. And I think that's what really set it off. And then from there, I came back around to the podcast because I was like, you know what? I want to do longer form stuff and I don't want to have a 45-minute video, especially because I don't want to edit all that. But I thought, you know what? I could do a podcast along with this. And so now I have Life After Sight Loss Radio, which is my podcast, has been going about almost 2 months now. And then I have a website, which is lifeaftersightloss.com, which I do a blog as well. And so all this started to come together to make kind of this, I don't know, let's say brand, if you will, for lack of a better term, this brand of like using my performance skills, my I'll say ministry skills. I'm not pushing Jesus on people or anything, but you know, that compassion, that understanding, that support and care for people, using that. And then, you know, also combining those with just the ability to connect with people online, combining all that to produce this content and support for people who are facing sight loss or going through sight loss or have recently lost their sight, you know, with understanding of what my story was, as we talked about, and reaching out and helping those people as well.
So in the couple of months that you've been doing the podcast, if you could talk a little bit more in depth, about the topics that you've covered thus far.
So like I said, my target audience are individuals and families who are facing or going through physical sight loss. So that includes the person losing their sight and their sighted supporters, such as spouses, children, friends, things like that. So the topics I'm covering are things like, one was about the stages of grief after you lose your sight. One was about how do I tell somebody, or when do I tell somebody that I'm visually impaired, like your employer or like people in your life that maybe you're not super close to, but do you tell them right away, you know, strangers, things like that. We talked about occupations after you lose your sight. You know, just it's the topics that I can dive deeper into because it's longer form content, and it's intended to not only, you know, just be informational, but entertaining and encouraging to people to say, hey, I lost my sight almost 16 years ago at the time of this recording, and I'm living and, you know, an awesome life. Now, am I some amazing superstar who makes like thousands of millions of dollars? No, but I live a great life, and they can too. You know, life's not over. And so I want to help people that are, again, losing their sight and their sighted supporters. My wife and I think have talked a lot about that, and I think we have some interesting insight on that. So we cover topics like that, you know, whether it's assistive technology all the way to dealing with grief and so forth when you go through loss of your sight.
You mentioned your wife in there with the YouTube channel as well as the podcast now. What does your wife and your family think about this endeavor for you?
Well, my son, who's 11, asks me all the time how many subscribers I have because he thinks it's great. My wife is, and she's not here, so I'm saying this all like not, it's super honest. It's not just for her benefits sitting here next to me or something, but she's amazing. And so she is always asking me, hey, what video are you making this week? What's your podcast going to be about? And one such event recently, I was in the other room and I heard something. And so I walked in there and she was listening to my latest podcast episode. I didn't ask her to listen to it. I didn't tell her all about it. She just on her own went, subscribed, and listened to the episode. Now, was she like super invested in it? Probably not. I think she was doing something else at the time. But she took the time to listen to it, and she's always engaged in my stuff. So she is so supportive. The next step, I just got to get her on the channel or on the podcast. She's not me. She's the opposite of me. We're you know, opposites attract. So I'm definitely the face, you know, like the performer, where she's much more the person who holds it all together in the background. But yeah, I mean, they're very supportive, very encouraging, asking me about things. I'll tell them about comments I got from people, or tell them about, oh, I'm going to be on this podcast, or I'm going to do this. And always very supportive and very exciting and encouraging.
That's really great to hear. And I think that that's very helpful, especially when you're doing something as engaging and time consuming as YouTubing and podcasting can be. A lot of recording time, a lot of editing time, a lot of invested time, just like any other 9-to-5 career could be. You're putting a lot of time and energy into it. And in this case, even with podcasting, it's not necessarily from 9-to-5. It could be any time. It could be any time, day or night, that you have time to do things. So having that support with your family definitely, I think, is a big help and probably a good boost for you to help you to continue to feel good about what you're working on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where you can really get bogged down with time consumption, because video editing, audio editing, all that stuff can take a long time. And it's not, I'm doing it from 9-to-5. I'm doing it, you know, at midnight sometimes. I'm doing it on the weekends. I'm doing it whenever I can. And I think it's really good to have support, because this, although I'm doing as much work as I would if I had a job, this isn't paying me money at this point. You know what I mean? YouTube's not giving me a bunch of ad revenue, and podcasting isn't making me money. I'm just doing this right now for free. And so it would be easy to be like, well, this is dumb. Just chuck this and go get a job or something. But my wife's been very encouraging and very supportive. And, you know, the goal maybe someday down the road is to make money from it, you know, as being a sight loss coach and helping people through that. But right now it's just to put that content out there to help people, to encourage people, to support people. And by having my wife be supportive of this, with it being just kind of quote unquote volunteer work with all the hours I put in, it's very helpful to help me keep going and doing it again the next week.
And that very nicely brings me into my next question, kind of a paraphrase on a question that a mentor of ours asks. Talk to me about what you hope to get out of the podcast, not necessarily what you've gotten out of it so far, or what it's done for you, but tell me going forward in the future, what is it that you hope to get out of this experience with the podcast, the website, blog, YouTube, all of this together? What are you hoping to get out of it for yourself? And then, of course, what are your hopes and dreams and goals going forward from life after sight loss?
Well, I think I'm one of those people that has, like, I can see at the end like what I want it to be. And then if I can't get there in a week, I'm like, well, forget it. I'll just check it all. Seeing it in the future, my hope is that it becomes a platform for people who are facing and going through physical sight loss. And so what that platform then would offer to people is, you know, it's kind of a personal brand, I guess, but, you know, I'm offering all this content, YouTube, blogs, podcasting, that sort of thing. And then what I would like to do with it is, one, you know, I have a background in ministry and education and counseling and coaching. And so I'd like to use that to help people on a one-on-one or maybe a group setting as a sight loss coach, that sort of thing, to help people walk through it. And I can do that locally or online or around the world, you know, that sort of thing. I'd like to offer products to people. Obviously, I'm not going to be a medical voice. I'm not going to be an O&M instructor, orientation mobility. There's, you know, places like that, but I want to be a connection point to those other places. So my focus will end, I think, eventually just kind of really focus on walking people through the transition and through maybe the first few years afterwards and getting them connected with O&M, getting them connected with life skills training, things like that, and helping them through that. So I would love for it to become kind of that personal branding where when you see Life After Sight Loss and you see me, and, you know, I want to do public speaking. I want to go share, whether it's at churches or conferences or whatever, to, and again, use that performance skill in me to do those public things and help people and share with people. Some of it's just an encouraging message, a motivational kind of speech. Some of it might be a little more technical and helping people. But eventually, I'd like to take the brand, the Life After Sight Loss kind of brand, and help people to walk through that transition and have a place where they can go and say, okay, I'm feeling down today. I'd love, do you have any encouraging content? And hopefully they can find something through that.
So now with everything that you've gone through, living the life that you have, losing your vision later on in life, and then being able to use the skills, the passions, the loves of different things that you obviously have, all that together, what then, from your experience, would you say to people initially going through this? If there was one thing that you'd want to say to a person who's just lost their vision, doesn't know what's going to happen next, they've lived maybe their own life for however many years, and they've got their passions, they know who they are as a person, but now this major part of them is either disappearing or gone, what would be one thing that you'd want that person to know?
Oh, gosh, I'd want them to know 1,000 things.
I know it's hard to just name one, absolutely. If you got a couple, that's okay. But yeah, just one kind of major, just what would that one big thing you'd say, you know what, this is what I've learned or this is what I want you to understand?
Well, I think one thing that people always say is, you know, they say, what's one piece of advice? And they say, it's not the end of the world. You know, they always say that line.
Sure.
And while that's a fine line, I think one thing I always say, and I close my podcast and my videos with it, is sight loss isn't the end. It's just the beginning. And so it's kind of like a new chapter in your life. There's a new beginning now. And I would say that while it's not the end of the world, it is the end of something. You know, there is a conclusion that has taken the place, because if it is a beginning, then there is an ending, and it's the end of the sighted life you had, not your life as a whole, but the life, quote unquote, as you knew it. And so I would just want people to be able to understand that and grieve that, you know, and say, well, so I'm sad about it. Yeah. Is that okay? Absolutely. And know that, you know, you're not going to get over that overnight, and that's perfectly okay.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good message to let people hear, is that, yes, this one part of your life may be different, may be gone, but it's not the end of your life. So I agree with that. When I hear you close your podcast that way, I think that's a really good piece of advice to give to people to help them understand that transition from one part of their life to a totally different part of their life.
I actually just did a video recently called the title was "My Story Doesn't Have a Good Ending," and I was kind of clickbait, but
sure.
The story, basically, it was saying that my story doesn't have a good ending. My story doesn't have a bad ending, because my story doesn't have an ending. It's not over yet. It has maybe its own starts and stops and beginnings and things like that, but it's not over. You know, if somebody's listening to this podcast right now, they don't have an ending either, and so it's important to remember that.
Absolutely. Well, Derek, I want to thank you very much for coming on the Life After Blindness Spotlight and talking with me today and sharing your journey and your story with our listeners and letting them know, again, that it can be done, that you can take your passions, you can take your interests, and even despite losing vision or having lost all vision, it still can be done, and you can have that different journey, and you can find that there can be that life after sight loss or after blindness, depending on which one of us you listen to. And and so I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with everybody.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, it's no problem, and I appreciate you coming on. And of course, I want to give you an opportunity to let everybody know where they can get more information about what you've been doing. I know we've talked about it a little bit here in the podcast, but officially, Derek, if anybody wants to get more information about what you're doing with all these different endeavors, go ahead and let everybody know how they can find you and how they can get in touch with you.
Well, I think the easiest way would be to go to lifeaftersightloss.com. Make sure if you're dictating that, you check the spelling of sight, because I found when I dictate it, it puts in S-I-T-E. So, but if you go to lifeaftersightloss.com, you can find the podcast. You can find my YouTube link. You can find that I'm on Twitter, on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. All this stuff, the blog post, everything is right there on that central hub. So, yeah, just hop on over there. And if you want to go straight to anything, it's usually like lifeaftersightloss.com/YouTube, lifeaftersightloss.com/podcast, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, hop on over to the website, lifeaftersightloss.com.
Very good. Well, I strongly encourage everybody out there to take a look at lifeaftersightloss.com. Take a look at what Derek is doing. I think this is very important work within our community. And as we've talked about on prior podcasts that Derek has been on with me, that I feel like this is, in a way, you know, partnership, a kinship, and an extension of what our goals and missions are here at Life After Blindness. And so I again encourage anybody who has that same feeling and interest that we do in these things and have that same passion, please definitely check out what Derek is doing. So again, Derek, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Tim.